stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, please think of us as a primary resource to get that question answered. Here is our number, 833-288-EWTN. Lines are open right now, 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email if you would prefer doing that. The address ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Calls are coming in right now. Pedro Quiles, our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on those platforms even as we speak. Just put your question in the comments box if you would, please. Either Rich or possibly Ace McKay will be putting that into our chat screen here. We'll get that question of yours answered ASAP. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm decent. Thanks.
We're adding to our EWTN coverage of the interregnum, the conclave, and the eventual election of a new Holy Father.
Well, it's exciting times.
It really is. It really is. And we are praying quite honestly. We are praying for their hard work to determine who that next Holy Father is going to be, and we're praying for that next man.
Well, you know, I haven't been Catholic my whole life, and I haven't been Catholic long enough to have experienced many papal interregna. I mean, I had no concept of the Catholic Church at the election of John Paul II, and he was, of course, one of the longest-serving popes in history.
Yeah.
So for most of my life, he was pope, and so I survived the interregnum between John Paul II and Benedict, and then Benedict and Francis. So I really only know two papal interregna, which is not much of a sample set to draw conclusions from. But you know, my experience has been it's impossible to you know put odds on what the conclave
will do. You just can't
do
it. Can't
that being
it.
Said, I can't help myself. You know? So I find myself reading all of the papabile articles from various Catholic media and, you know, listening to the speculations and getting ideas and talking up different candidates. But, of course, at the end, I know it's all going to be for naught, and no one, I don't know.
Here's a pro tip for you and for all of our listeners. Keep it on EWTN.
Keep it on EWTN.
That is the smart move.
But, you know, I also like to read the Register. I get a lot of good stuff out of the Register.
Absolutely. Here's an email from John in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. He says, I was in an Acts Bible study, had a question about Acts 15:20. I understand three of the four provisos made for the Gentiles. Is there something somewhere which addresses consuming blood? And that's, again, from John in Texas.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So the consumption of blood was off limits for Jews. It's not off limits for Gentiles. And yes, you can go eat your boudin and have your blood sausage, and you're not violating any moral strictures on the Christian church. But that was in there for that time for the sake of the consciences of the Jewish members of the church, because that was just something that was so taboo that, you know, a big issue about whether they could share table fellowship with Christians.
Oh, right? Okay.
And Jews who were Christians in the first century did not stop practicing Judaism. They didn't cease going to synagogue. They didn't stop circumcising their children. They didn't stop following the laws of Kashrut. The debate was over whether Christians had to also adopt those same rules. And, of course, the church came to the decision, no, the Gentiles don't have to follow Jewish dietary practices to be Christians.
Okay.
But if you're going to hang out with Jews, you know, show some deference. That was
well,
the
sure.
idea. That
sure.
was the idea.
Very good. Thanks so much for your question there, John. Here's one now from Brian in Shelby Township, Michigan. Dr. Anders, oftentimes when you give biblical justification for purgatory, you cite 2 Maccabees and also 2 Timothy 1, stating that Paul prays for his deceased friend Onesiphorus. 2 Timothy 1, 18 states, quote, "May the Lord grant that he will find mercy from the Lord on that day." I or any Protestant could easily read that as if he were still alive, and Paul's just praying for the Lord's mercy on Onesiphorus on that day when he dies and meets the Lord in the future. So, why is it necessarily to be read that he's already dead? Am I missing something from the original Greek rendering of the verse?
No, and this is not a slam dunk argument, and I'm not looking for a proof text. I think the weight of the evidence from the context suggests that Onesiphorus is dead. There's no direct greeting to Onesiphorus. There's no recognition of his ongoing ministry. The language and context suggests that Onesiphorus has already died. The kind of prayer is the sort of thing you find in 2 Maccabees. I'm not looking for a proof text. I'm trying to look for a larger context in which there's Christian prayers on behalf of the dead. Now, it's not controversial that if you look outside the New Testament, this is a standard Jewish practice in the first century and continues to be to this day, right? There's a place in the Jewish liturgy that prays for the dead. You can see from Maccabees that it was a common practice in Second Temple Judaism. We know from archaeology, Judahite burial practices, going back to the 8th century, included rites like this for the dead. The Protestant biblical scholar Joachim Jeremias wrote a book a number of years ago, a long time ago, several decades ago. It's only in German, unfortunately. I don't think it's been translated into English, but it's about the graves of the holy dead and their veneration in first century Judaism. And there's one cryptic reference to it in the New Testament when Jesus criticizes the Pharisees for decorating the tombs of the martyrs without imitating their virtues.
Mm.
Right? And so there's a recognition in there.
Uh-huh.
That this was a practice contemporary in Jesus' day. So there's archaeological evidence, there's Jewish liturgical evidence, there's extra-biblical evidence, and then there are some passages within the New Testament and Old that, seen within that larger context, I think can plausibly be interpreted as prayers for the dead. But that's just one piece of a larger argument for the doctrine of purgatory.
Brian, thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we'll talk with Rick in St. Louis, Kevin in Oregon. Lines are open for you also at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. We have three lines open right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. During the break here, we were getting into a discussion, David and I, regarding the actual voting process. And it's been the last few conclaves, it's been very short periods of time.
Since 1958.
Yeah?
No papal conclave has lasted longer than 4 days.
Really?
And they have gone 4 days, 3 days, 2 days, 1 day.
1 day.
Yeah. So Pope Francis was elected in a 24-hour conclave.
That is absolutely amazing.
So it'd be interesting to see, do we buck that trend and get it done in 6 hours?
Time will tell.
Or will it take a week and a half? Who knows?
Fascinating. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. You can ask questions about the conclave or the interregnum, which is what we're in right now, or anything else that's on your mind, especially all of you non-Catholics who are listening. This is all brand new to you folks. 833-288-3986. You know, EWTN podcasts are available on Audible, a very popular platform. Weekday shows from the Sunrise Morning Show through Ave Maria in the afternoon, plus all the latest weekend programming. You can find it on the Audible app. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning today with Rick in St. Louis, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Tom, Dr. Anders. Thanks for taking my call. I have a very close first cousin who was raised Catholic, was married Catholic, since has been divorced, and now is marrying in a non-Catholic. He seeks no annulment. He doesn't want an annulment. He's abandoned his Catholic faith. He gave me a phone call, wants me to come to the wedding. He sent me an invitation. He's expecting me to come. Am I allowed to go to this wedding? And if not, is it a sin if I do go?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So there is no, there's no canon law in the church that would forbid your going. And so the question of whether or not to go to such a thing is a matter of prudence. And what you would be concerned about are weighing the sin of scandal versus the loss of relationship with your cousin. And that's what you have to decide.
Yeah,
and that is a prudential consideration. So, you know, if you were to refrain from going, you would have to ask yourself the question, what is my objective in refraining from going? To whom am I signaling my non-compliance? If it's the cousin, if you don't go because you want him to know that you don't approve, then a question I would ask would be, is that going to persuade him to change his mind or to reconsider his marital situation? Is that likely to happen? Are you the person who's best suited to make that admonition, and is this the best context in which to make it? I'm not going to answer those questions for you. Another consideration would be, is there somebody else in your life who would be led into error by your going? Like, let's say you have, I'm just making this up off the top of my head. You have a 25-year-old son who's kind of on the fence about whether to have a Catholic wedding or not. He's marrying a non-Catholic girl, and she'd like to get married in the Methodist church, but she'd concede to have a Catholic priest there, but mm-hmm. that's kind of touchy with her family, and so it's going to create difficulties, and you're in that kind of a dicey situation where this sort of decision on your part, if I go to my cousin's wedding, that might tilt the balance against the Catholic wedding for my son, who's having a, you know, crisis of conscience, and I better make a stand here if I want to help my son make the right choice. That sort of thing could play in, right? If none of that pertains, you know, you might weigh the other factor, which is that, you know, if I don't go to this thing, am I going to cost myself a permanent relationship to my cousin and lose any future possibility of being a Catholic influence in his life? Because the odds are he's going to go through with this thing whether I want him to or not. The question is, do I want to maintain a relationship with him going forward? And those are the pastoral considerations that you have to make.
Is that helpful for you, Rick?
It is helpful. Would it be a sin is there a sin involved?
Yeah. So again, this is where prudence comes in. I mean, on the face of it, prima facie, no, right? But if you felt like my decision to go is going to be an occasion of sin for somebody very close to me, like, you know, like your son or somebody like that, for example, where my actions are going to be interpreted as formal cooperation. Formal cooperation means that you intend the evil outcome, right? As opposed to material cooperation. Well, you know, that you're never supposed to formally cooperate with a sin, and it wouldn't be a good idea, even if you're not formally cooperating, to send the message that you're formally cooperating. And, there's different ways of handling this. I'm not telling you what to do here. I'm giving you context. Sometimes in these situations, it can be helpful if you have the right kind of relationship to say to somebody, you know, I love you, I support you, I want you to be happier in life, and I care about this girl that you're with. You know, I don't actually regard this as valid because you're canonically Catholic, and I sure wish you'd reconsider the decision, but I'm going to be there regardless because I want you to know that I love and care about you. But, you know, my attendance does not signal formal cooperation. I mean, you can do, I'm not saying
sure.
You have to, but that's a thing you could do that would remove that piece of the puzzle just immediately.
Rick, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Three lines open, 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go to Oregon and talk with Kevin, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I finally got through to you guys.
Yay. All right. Good job, Kevin.
Listen to you on the radio all the time.
Great.
So I just saw Carlos Acutis. I saw it twice. Very good movie about his life.
Oh, good.
But at the end of the movie, there's a clip from the Eucharistic conference that was held. And they say, although they didn't say it in the clip of the movie, I heard it listening to it on the radio, that 70% of all Catholics do not believe in the Eucharist. And to me, I was raised Catholic. I've been listening to the Catholic radio here in Salem, Oregon for the past 2 years. Christ is in heaven. That is where Christ is, in heaven. Why do you believe that the priest has the ability to turn that into the actual body and blood of Christ?
Right. Thanks. I appreciate the question. A couple things on the statistics about Catholics who believe or don't believe in the Eucharist. So there was a Pew research study that came out a number of years ago that got a lot of headlines that claimed that 70% of Catholics don't believe in the real presence. But as with all surveys, the results you get depend a lot on how you word the question. And the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate conducted a survey much more recently that framed the question much more precisely, and you get almost the flip result. You get 70% belief and 30% disbelief. But it doesn't matter to me one way or another. If you did a survey and you found that 95% of Catholics disbelieved some dogma of the faith, I would be untroubled. I mean, I'd be troubled for them, but like that wouldn't bother me in the terms of the security of my faith, right? The reason why is that if you could do another survey and be like, okay, what percentage of the Catholics have mastered the virtue of temperance? I think you would find that it would be very low.
Yeah.
You'd get low numbers, you know. They'd be very high among people that, among canonized saints.
Yes.
And very low for the vast majority of Catholics,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
And the church is kind of like, I'm going to use this metaphor cautiously because there's a trope in Catholic land called cafeteria Catholic, which means somebody that picks and chooses what they want from the faith. I don't mean it in that sense. The Catholic Church is a little bit like a buffet. Maybe a gym is a better analysis, where there are all these tools,
yeah,
that exist to strengthen you and to promote your flourishing, right?
Okay. All right.
You know, if you don't go to the gym or you don't use the equipment properly, you're not going to benefit from it.
Nope.
And so if you look at the Catholic Church as a kind of suite of spiritual services that have been specially designed and curated for your spiritual healing, that's what the church has to offer. But the extent to which people actually benefit from it will depend entirely on the extent to which they appropriate those goods. Interestingly, I think it was Pius XI. It was Pius XI who wrote Casti Connubii, right?
I believe so, yeah.
It was an encyclical on marriage in the first part of the 20th century. Uh-huh. Has a remarkable statement in that encyclical where he talks about the sacrament of matrimony. And he said, for most Catholics, I couldn't believe it when he said that, but he said, for most Catholics, the sacrament of matrimony is like a treasure buried in a field, meaning it's a treasure that they don't take advantage of. They're not actually benefiting from the sacramental grace because they don't properly cooperate. I thought that was an astonishing admission for the Pope.
It really
to make,
is,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true. I mean, I think it goes to the heart of my experience. When I look at my own Catholic life, for example, I mean, how often do I take full advantage of everything the Church has for me? Well, not very often.
Yeah.
And I mean, I miss out a lot, right, because of my own laziness or whatever, you know, my own weakness. So that's just the way humans are, and I'm not particularly troubled by that. As a Catholic, I of course completely agree with your statement that Christ is in heaven, and the dogma of transubstantiation does not contradict that. It does not deny that Christ is in heaven. And if you attend to the language that the Church uses, you said actual. Sometimes I've heard people say physically present. Neither one of those are the terms the Church uses to describe the Eucharist. The Church does not define Christ as physically present in the elements. It doesn't describe Christ. It doesn't use the word actual, although you could use actual. Physical is more problematic. It uses the word real, really present. More precisely, it uses the word substantially present. So it specifies a particular mode of presence that is distinct from the mode of presence that Christ enjoys in heaven, and distinct from the mode of presence that he had during his earthly ministry. It is a mode of presence that is unique to the Eucharist. It is a mode of presence where the properties of Christ's physical body are absent. Weight, extension in space, color, smell, you name it. None of those are bodily motion. None of those are present. Well, that's pretty mysterious stuff. I can't conceive of a presence that lacks all of those elements and yet can still be described as real. But I know what I'm not claiming. I'm not claiming that Christ has ceased to be in heaven. Somehow Christ is physically in heaven, and yet his body, blood, and soul, and divinity are substantially, which is a different mode, substantially present in all the consecrated hosts. Why do I believe that? Given that, A, I can't fully conceptualize it, and B, many Catholics don't believe that, but I believe it because Christ taught it. There's no other reason. I just believe it on authority. Christ taught it. The Catholic Church confirmed it. And as such, it functions in Catholic life, among other things, as an identity marker. And so, you know, I didn't become Catholic because of the doctrine of the Eucharist. I believe in the doctrine of the Eucharist because I became Catholic.
Ah.
Right? And there are other considerations that led me to the heart of the Catholic faith. But having become Catholic, I see that there are some other benefits. So the Church regards the Eucharist as a sacrifice, something that is offered to God, and that by my participation, that I am made a partaker, first of all, in the Catholic community. So St. Paul refers to the Eucharist as the sacrament of the Church's unity, because we are, because we all partake of the one loaf, we are one body in Christ, right? And the language of the Mass itself, if you attend to the language of the Eucharistic prayer, the celebrant makes that request specific, that may we who share in this body of Christ be made one, right? And so this idea of an identity marker, it's not just hand waving. Like there's a, I remember when I had my first Holy Communion, I don't know what I expected. I know some people expect fireworks. I did not get fireworks. It was actually just a Sunday Mass. I had been confirmed the previous Sunday, and so the next Sunday I just went to Mass, went forward in the communion line, and had my first communion. It was kind of undramatic. Most people have it differently than that, but that's how I did it. I went forward, I received communion, and I remember I no fireworks went off. I didn't have a tingly sensation. I felt a little bit sick to my stomach, honestly, because I violated a longstanding Protestant taboo, and I had grown up Protestant. And been taught my whole life that the Eucharist was a kind of blasphemy and a sacrilege and false dogma and all that. And so wow. I had to overcome a lot of Protestant conditioning to even go forward and receive communion. Mm. And when I received communion, I walked away with one very settled conviction, and it was, well, I've gone and done it now. I really am a Catholic. And there are many other things you could say about it. But at the very least, I mean, I think that's true. And the Church, it very much intends that. It's a sacrament of initiation. To receive communion in the Catholic Church is to be fully initiated into the Catholic life, into the body of Christ, which is the Church, through the body of Christ that's present in the consecrated species.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wanted me a piece of that, as it were. You know, I wanted to join myself to a tradition that was 2,000 years old that went back to the apostles. To the living body of the Catholic faithful that's extended throughout the entire world. That's what Catholic means. And I wanted to belong to that communion. And so I went in and embraced and accepted everything that the Church declared to be revealed by God. And doggone it, I received communion. And I really am a Catholic now in consequence.
Yes, you are. Kevin, thank you so much for your call from Oregon. Glad that you're checking in today. In a moment, we'll be talking with Pat in one of the many Springfields across America. This one, Springfield, Illinois. Pat is listening to us on the Great Covenant Network. We have lines open for you. It's not too late to call 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Glad you're with us for the Thursday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Lines are open for you. It's not too late to call 833-288-EWTN. Maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. 833-288-EWTN. 888-288-3986. Hey, if you're listening to us in Southern California, your EWTN radio station needs to hear from you next week. The great St. John Paul II Catholic Radio will be airing their spring pledge drive, and that'll be starting on Tuesday of next week. So if you're listening in San Diego or Escondido, El Centro, or anywhere, please remember to support your Catholic radio station. Vitally important to keep these signals on the air for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. All right, let's go to Pat now, a first-time caller from Springfield, Illinois, listening on the Great Covenant Network. Hello, Pat. What's on your mind today?
Hi. First of all, I love you guys' show. It's just excellent. I just always try to tune into it. But I was wondering, I've always heard that, you know, we refer to God the Father as the invisible God. And I'm just curious, I've always wondered, does God have form? And I know, like in the Bible, it says man was made in God's image, and Jesus said that only he has seen the Father. And yet I've seen, like, you know, pictures of, like, the one where God the Father's over the cross with Jesus on the cross. And I was just wondering your take on that, please.
Yeah, thanks. So the Catholic dogma is that God has no visible form, certainly not some anthropomorphic form, you know, like a guy with a white beard. So in spite of its beauty, the Sistine Chapel with the, you know, the creation of Adam, great art, bad theology. and that's not how God is. God is immaterial, eternal, omnipresent, you know, as he's not extended in space, he's immense, meaning that all of God's essence is present to every particle of creation. And there's not more of God in an elephant than in a mouse, right? All of God is entirely present everywhere simultaneously. Here's an analogy. In the same way that, say, the Pythagorean theorem is fully represented in a triangle of any size and in multiple triangles at the same time, right? You know, God is not a geometric theorem, but you see the idea.
Sure. Right?
Nor is he an abstract entity. He's a real entity, but you get the analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And we are made in God's likeness and image, but that doesn't refer to our physical form. In Catholic dogma, to be made in the image of God means that we are moral creatures possessed of rationality and moral freedom, so that we can deliberate about good and evil, and make rationally informed moral choices. That's the manner in which we're made in God's likeness and image. Now, that is marred, of course, by original sin and our habitual weakness and concupiscence and egotism and so forth. And so we need to be healed of that. And so what is restored to us through Christ is what we lost in Adam, namely to be fully in God's likeness and image. Our closeness to God, our relationship to God is a participated likeness. Again, to borrow the analogy of the Pythagorean theorem and the triangle, or maybe let's take, you know, something a little bit more concrete than that. Let's say take the concept of a triangle, or maybe a circle. You know, that's all the points that are equidistant from a single point. You know, at some you know, definite radius. Right?
Yeah.
Well, like you will find no perfect circle in nature. Right, you only find approximations, right? I mean, it's an abstract entity, the perfect circle, right? So if you imagine all your particular circles, like the rim of this coffee cup I have right here, it's probably not a perfect circle, particularly because I'm squeezing on it. It's a little bit oblong at the moment, you know, but it's more or less there, right? But you could think about, you know, the coffee cup that is more or less participating in the idea of the perfect circle, right?
Yeah.
That's the way that we are like God, right? We have a participated relationship in God's in his life, in his holiness, in his justice, in his rationality. But we do it kind of to a limited extent. We can improve in our likeness to God. We can come closer in our participation of God through sanctifying grace and practice of the virtues and so forth. But that's the manner in which we become more like him. It's not, you know, it doesn't matter whether I filled out a new application for a passport today.
Yeah.
And online, you can do it. You used to be able to do it online. Then you couldn't do it online. Now you can do it online again. So I was very happy about that. And I was going through marking off, you know, the different elements, and there was a question in there, you know, hair, height, weight, eye color, hair color. The only item that hadn't changed was eye color. You know, and I called my wife and I said, Jill, tell me honestly, can I say that my hair is brown or is it gray? And she said, I hate to tell you, buddy, it's gray.
Yeah. You're not in that boat by yourself, you know.
No, and it had been brown for so long.
Yep.
It was brown for the last one, but it was gray today. But all those things don't matter, right, to my likeness and image of God, right? It's my moral character that is reflective of that image.
Yes, indeed.
And so that's why we can say that only Jesus has seen the Father also, because only Christ is united in his person to the essence of the Godhead through the hypostatic union. So his relationship to God in his humanity is participated, but in his divinity is identical, right? They share one essence. And so he has a likeness and a closeness to the Father that's unlike anything in the created realm.
Pat, thanks so much for your call from Springfield, Illinois. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for a call or two at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here now, Michael in Kentucky, listening on TuneIn Radio, longtime carrier of ours. Hello, Michael. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I am a baptized Christian and wanting to go become part of the Catholic Church. And started OCI last year, but I have a severe disability, and so one of the things that I just wasn't able to attend, and so that happened. Well, I realized that baptized Christians, you know, could have a special track in OCIA and don't necessarily need to wait until the Easter Vigil. But it seems like, you know, in my church and in my diocese that they want everybody to be on that September to Easter Vigil track. And then the other thing that was kind of disappointing is, you know, I'm very open about my disability. And just because I want to be a model to do away with the stigma. But it seems like the church really does not know what to do with a reasonable accommodation request.
Okay.
Thank you. So I have a number of thoughts on that. First of all, it is not canonically necessary for all candidates for confirmation to go through RCIA. I myself am a convert to the Catholic Church, and I did not go through RCIA. I was confirmed in November by a parish priest at a private ceremony, right? And so that's all fine. You can do that. You need to do it with your pastor's permission. It can happen that a particular Catholic priest may not want to do that, and then that's when you go to another Catholic priest. I mean, that's just how this works, and you may have to switch parishes or whatnot. The bishop can grant faculties to any priest to confirm. And so, you know, if the buck stops with the bishop. If the bishop doesn't want to do that, then you're stuck. But, you know, I would exhaust your options, first of all. If it's physically impossible for you to go to OCIA, I mean, I would make that case. I mean, I would maybe write out a letter to the pastor. Or, I mean, if worse comes to worse, you know, write the bishop or his office and say, it is my sincere desire to become Catholic. I am physically prevented from going to RCIA for the following reasons. Could you please make a reasonable accommodation in my case, right? I'm sorry that you have to go through this rigmarole. You know, when it comes to reasonable accommodations for disability, I think you're correct that the Catholic Church of North America is behind the curve here. I have some friends that work in this area that full-time in inclusion awareness for disability services, and some of these people are Catholic. I don't know that they have any particular clout with bishops, but I know some folks that have pretty good resources on how to inform institutions such as parishes and schools and so forth about how to accommodate. You know, if you wanted to write the show off air, I'd be happy to put you in touch with some of those folks. But again, that's more at the level of, you know, how do you construct your architecture, not how do you, but you know, I don't know, maybe we could get some advocacy going. So I might be able to help you there a little bit if you want to write the show off the air, and I can put you in touch with some folks that I know.
Yeah, if you want to do that, Michael, send it to ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com, and be sure to remind us, you know, about this particular conversation so that we can hopefully hook you up there. All right, let's go to John in Michigan, listening on the Great Holy Family Radio. Hello, John. What's on your mind today, sir?
Okay, question. This is about the selection of the Pope. Two questions. When they go into the conclave, of course, they say voting cardinals less than 80 years old. Does that mean that's the only cardinals that are going to be in there and the other older cardinals are not?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the older cardinals, I'm not sure. Tom, are they allowed to attend the conclave and just not cast a vote?
I think so. I believe that's the way it works.
I think they can attend but not cast a vote. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I think so. Was that did you have another question, John?
Okay, well, then the other question was, who can be selected? Obviously, we've only had cardinals selected, but I think that's a much broader. I don't know what the definition of is who can be elected a pope.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So the pope is by definition the Bishop of Rome.
Yes.
And so a Catholic man who could at least be ordained to the episcopacy prior to his election is potential pope material, right? And there have been popes elected that were not cardinals at the time of their election. Practically speaking, that doesn't happen anymore. It is almost always going to be somebody from the College of Cardinals, but it has not always been the case. During the papal schism of the Middle Ages, when you had, you know, multiple contenders for the papacy all fighting each other and this kind of thing, there was a case where the conclave said, you know, we need to elect somebody of exceeding holiness to try to put an end to this thing. So they went out and found this you know, monkish hermit that they thought was some excellent fellow, and they made him pope, and he was a disaster. He was horrible. He had absolutely no administrative skill at all. But, I mean, like, there's some precedent for that in Catholic history.
Okay.
And so it could be done. It's just not likely to happen.
Okay. John, thanks so much for a great call there. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Have you been to Podcast Central yet? We talk about that quite a bit because we're very proud of it, where you can check out over 100 great podcasts, not only programs that we produce, but some of our partners as well. One of those is called The Road to Emmaus, provided to us from the St. Paul Center. Dr. Scott Hahn presents the deeply biblical roots of Catholic teaching and practice. Join Dr. Hahn to learn how sacred scripture forms and informs our notions of morality and spirituality, liturgy and the sacraments, and so much more. Check that out, The Road to Emmaus with Dr. Scott Hahn, one of the great podcasts on EWTN's Podcast Central. Here's how you get there, EWTN.com/radio. Look for the words in the upper right corner, I believe, Podcast Central. Click on that and off you go. All right, back to the phones now. Here is Dominic in Greenwood, Indiana, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Dominic, what's on your mind today, sir?
All right, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I got a question about, I'd like to know what exactly a mystic is, or what the definition of mystic or mysticism. And part B was, what makes somebody a doctor of the church? What are the qualifications?
Great questions. Great questions, both of them. So I like the mysticism question particularly because there's an area of great confusion. And in popular culture, the word mystic gets thrown around in a lot of different ways that are not all compatible. So sometimes in popular culture, not Catholic theology, but in popular culture, a mystic is is someone that has woo-woo experiences, you know, that they have eldritch affairs, they have visions or dream dreams or get funny feelings or whatnot, you know. or they end up in Van Morrison songs. You know? that's a popular notion of the mystic, and it's obviously not what we're talking about. Yeah. Another instance is sometimes people use mystic or mystical to refer to something secretive or hidden or esoteric. And again, that's not what we mean in this case. In Catholic theology, mysticism means nothing more, nothing less than a participated, an experiential knowledge of the truths of the faith. And so, you know, as Catholics, we can, say, learn the catechism. We can learn what the Church objectively teaches about, say, the doctrine of the Trinity or something. We could also learn where Jesus says in the Gospel of John, if you love me and keep my commandments, my Father and I will come to you and make our dwelling within you. Oh, okay, I've just learned the doctrine of the indwelling Trinity. Great, okay. That's different from the question, is the Trinity indwelling you? And so a mystic is someone who experiences life in the Trinity, not someone who just talks about it.
Okay.
And to demystify that even more, what does it mean for the Trinity to indwell you? What does it mean to be indwelt? Well, St. Thomas Aquinas gives a beautiful explanation. He says that God indwells us in the way that the known is in the knower and the beloved is in the lover. I think it's very clear and very wonderful. And so to take an analogy, I know my wife and I love her. And so there are things about my wife's person and character and interests and values that become my own because she cares about certain things. Like, here's an example. My wife cares a lot about domestic animals. I like domestic animals fine, but I'm not nutso for the domestic animals the way she is. But because my wife is into domestic animals, like heavily into them, I find myself cleaning cat litter boxes far more often than I would if I were not married to my wife.
Ditto.
like I would never clean cat litter boxes if I weren't married to my wife.
Right there with you buddy.
And so that is proof that I have taken her interests on as my own, right? To the extent that I know God intimately, the same thing happens, right? That God's priorities become my priorities. Christ's way of being in the world, his way of looking at things, becomes my way of being in the world, my way of looking at things. And as I'm more and more conformed to Christ's likeness and image, that becomes true more and more and more, right? Now, there is a pretty well-defined doctrine of spiritual progress in the Catholic tradition. But how do you do that? How do you actually get to the point where where Christ's values become yours and second nature to you? And there are a lot of practices that you can undergo. There are rituals you can undergo, like the sacraments. There are beliefs that you can hold. There are practices, you know, like daily prayer and you know, works of charity and so forth. But they're all means to an end, and the end is that conformity of the self to Christ. Now, along the way, people who take that personal transformation very, very seriously sometimes have esoteric experiences. Sometimes they have woo-woo experiences. And the mistake that people make is conflate the woo-woo experiences with the holy. And so, for example, if you read Teresa of Avila, who's one of the great mystics of the Catholic tradition, you read her autobiographical writings, she will talk about some of her woo-woo experiences, and people who don't know better will read them and go, ah, that's a mystic. I need to have woo-woo experiences. And they forget that Teresa says, forget all about woo-woo experiences. John of the Cross was another guy who had woo-woo experiences, and he's a saint and a mystic. But he says explicitly, you should run from woo-woo experiences because they have too much of the body and the flesh about them.
Mm.
Right. And we're looking for a conformity that's moral and not sensible. And so that's where people go wrong. You can be a mystic and have an utterly arid interior life, meaning no sensible contact with God whatsoever. A good example of that would be Mother Teresa of Calcutta, whose inner experience of God was, I mean, by all accounts, painful, arid, dry, and lonely. I mean, she tells us this explicitly in her autobiographical writings. And yet you look at the character of her life. I mean, I have read staunch critics of Mother Teresa, people who rejected her and her apostolate and her order, who said, you know, whatever fault I may find with the woman, she was personally the most charitable individual I'd ever been around in my life. That's what we're talking about. That's the mark of a true mystic, right, in the Catholic sense of the term, not all the woo-woo stuff.
Okay.
All right, now, what's a doctor of the church? Doctor of the church is an office. It's a title that is granted to very select people in Catholic history whose teaching is regarded as authoritative in a special way, that they are singled out as guides to the Catholic life and Catholic thought, Catholic way of being in the world, Catholic way of answering intellectual and moral questions. Doesn't mean everything a doctor of the church says is infallible, but it does mean these are sure guides and points of reference, and you should enrich your intellectual and spiritual life by consulting what they have said, what they have written.
And it is indeed a select group. I believe it's like under 3 dozen people.
Yes, it's not a pile, not a big pile of people.
There you go. And Dominic, thanks so much for your call from Greenwood, Indiana. Let's go now to Patty. Patty's a first-time caller from Kearney, Nebraska, listening on the Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Hello, Patty. What's on your mind today?
Yes, quick question. So my husband recently had a cousin that got married. They're supposed to have an outdoor wedding. We were not at the wedding, but had an outdoor wedding, but it got, like, had to get changed because of the weather. So they got married in the Catholic church that was, like, in the same town. And neither one are Catholic, and had an officiant do the marriage. I guess myself being a Catholic, I thought there were, like, more rule, or there's, like, is that okay, I guess?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So in terms of the validity of your cousin's
yeah.
marriage,
yeah.
non-Catholics are obviously not obligated to have Catholic weddings, and they are not obligated to have their weddings officiated by a priest. I mean, a non-Catholic marrying a non-Catholic could go to a justice of the peace or to a minister of their own church or, you know, to a humanist chaplain if they were a humanist. I mean, like really, really, the important thing about a marriage, a natural marriage, a non-sacramental marriage, is simply the promise of the parties to give themselves to one another for the sake of raising a family in a relationship of lifelong fidelity and exclusivity, right? I mean, that's the, you know, that and the intent to raise a family by some means of sexual cooperation. I mean, that's pretty much the essence of the vow of marriage. And you do that, you're married, and the officiant is kind of an afterthought, not an afterthought, but it's a witness not necessary intrinsically to the validity of marriage, except if you're Catholic. It's a little bit different. You have to have a celebrant who's a representative of the church if you're Catholic.
Right, right.
So it's not invalid, all right? The thing that gives me pause is that it would be very unusual for a Catholic church to, like, rent out their sacred space for a non-Catholic, non-sacramental wedding. That's highly unusual. I'm not actually sure what the law is on this, but all my intuitions tell me this is funny business. And again, I'm not a canonist. This is not an area of specialty of mine, but that does strike me as very, very odd that they would use a Catholic space that way for a non-Catholic event. I mean, I could see the Catholic Church renting out its parish hall for a reception.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not normal practice for Catholics to let its sacred space be used for sort of non-Catholic sacred rites.
Patty, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. A quick email here from Mark in Carrollton, Texas. Dr. Anders, other than the several books that the Protestants removed, is the text of the King James or some of the other versions identical to our Bible?
So that's a good question. The Catholic Church does not have a definitive text, actually, in the sense that there are many, many different biblical manuscript traditions that propose different readings of the same biblical text.
Yeah.
And they're variants, in other words.
Uh-huh.
And the church has never dogmatically defined one set of variants as the authentic one, right? I mean, this is a matter for scholarship. Modern Catholic biblical translations are usually based on critical texts, mm-hmm. meaning they're scholarly reproductions that are an attempt to get at what the best early manuscripts, you know, were. But they rely on scholarly judgments, and they don't correspond to any single manuscript, but reflect, you know, comparisons of multiple manuscripts against multiple manuscript families. The King James is much more narrowly focused in its textual decisions. It's based on what's called the Textus Receptus, or the received text, which is a Byzantine manuscript tradition that was the one that was available to Erasmus when he made his first Greek translation of the New Testament. It's favored by King James-only fundamentalist Protestants, not regarded as the best manuscript by biblical scholars today, Catholic, Protestant, or not religious. And so it would not be the same as the biblical text that would be used, say, in Catholic Mass. But the Catholic Church wouldn't condemn the textual basis, because it just hasn't formed a judgment about that in an sure. official capacity.
Mark, thanks so much for your email. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN. Hope you can join us for the Friday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thank you for joining us. Keep it right here on EWTN. God bless.